Hey everyone, thanks for your patience, thanks for coming this evening. My name is Laurent, I'm with Somerset House Studios working on our public program events. I'm just going to do a quick intro to what's going on this evening and then I'll hand it on over to Ash and to Geika to get started. So Ash Sarkar is a writer, broadcaster, journalist and lecturer living in London. She's a senior editor at Novara Media where her work focuses on race, gender, class and power. As part of her work, she has appeared on numerous panels, hosted live events, and interviewed front bench politicians on everything from foreign policy to football opinions. Ash supports Tottenham Hotspur and has never knowingly kissed a Tory. Geika is a multidisciplinary recording and visual artist working across genres and platforms to create compelling audiovisual experiences. The technically complex worlds Geika creates merge the futuristic with the contemporary culture, shifting the paradigms of what it means to be a black musician in Britain today. Hopefully some of you would have been next door where you'd be able to see what he's currently worked on, which was a commission by Boiler Room to create system and audiovisual installation telling the story, the history of sound culture in Notting Hill Carnival and beyond. System runs up until the 26th of August, presented by Somerset House Studios, and he's recently also just released a new album on Warp Records. So here we go, I'll hand on over to Ash and we can get started.
Thank you all for coming here tonight rather than getting mashed in a beer garden. I could understand if you want to do that. This is much better. But yeah, thank you. It's a real privilege to be able to do this conversation because I remember when I heard your work for the very first time. So I was completely off my tits at my friend's house. And I think it was Wildstar, like come on shuffle. And I could barely hold my face together, but I was like, oh my God, this sounds like the future. And that sense of you bringing something really different, something that was confrontational, something which wasn't easy to listen to but was compelling, has stayed with me ever since. So now it's great that I get to fire you with questions in front of loads of people.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you were mashed that day.
Yeah, it was. I think it helped things along. I mean, let's start with the installation. Let's start with System. What is the urgency of this piece? Why did you feel that you had to make it, and why did you feel they have to do it now?
You know, it's Boris Johnson. Like, I think that immigrant has become a dirty word somehow. Somehow we're supposed to make excuses for existing in the country that we were born in or came to make a better life. That doesn't sit right with me. It's never okay. It's never, oh, it will pass. It seems urgent. And I think between the Windrush scandal and all the kind of just xenophobia, I really wanted to make something that was about space, holding space, surviving within it, and expanding. And the opportunity just arose and I jumped on it.
I mean, so you think about Boris Johnson, you're thinking about like these quite, I don't know, like rooted in now, like political conflicts, but there's also this like long sense of history that's behind this piece, or that at least what I'm getting at is that you're talking about the survival of a people over decades, if not centuries. So, like, what's your sense of history?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, that was one of the reasons why I was the kind of urgency, the nowness of it was the reason why I kind of hyper focused on it and really tried to make something that spoke to what is happening now, but ultimately can only come from the history of my life, the history of the community from which I come. My dad was in the sound system in the 70s before he decided to become a scientist, and it always struck me the kind of technical prowess that he had just came from that culture. And my earliest memories were going to like the last dregs of, you know, blues parties and just always being kind of adjacent to that world, but like viewing it through this technical lens or this familial lens, and also a political one, you know. And to me, sound system culture, I don't know, it represents defiance in many ways, and it kind of always has. And an inversion of, you know, using the education that you were given or what you taught yourself, rather than making, you know, weapons or commercial, like put into commercial use to get rich. It's about the betterment or for the enjoyment of everyone. And I mean, that's been a historical thing. Like, I guess it's connected to the end of the war. So it's like, what do we do with all this metal? What do we do with all this skill that we've developed killing each other, or some people have developed killing each other, and it's kind of transported to the Caribbean. You know what? Let's make this.
I mean, there is that sense of, like, inherent warfare to it, right? Like the taking of territory, the claiming of territory, even like the parades of like drums through the streets. Like there is this inherently combative element to it. I don't know. And also you're sitting here basically wearing like a flak jacket and shit. So I guess that's just like prominent in my mind.
I just like that style though. No, I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, look, like when my grandparents came over, you know, they told me the stories, getting chased by Teddy Boys, you know, like through the West End. It wasn't all, you know, it wasn't roses. And rather than like run away and like leave or be cowed, essentially we're like, well, I tell you what, we're going to dance in the street. We're going to make as much noise as we can, like until you tell us to stop. When you tell us to stop, we're going to keep on doing it and then fight the police. You know, it's like, it is definitely combative. I think actually, I mean, look at them sound systems. They're big, they're imposing. They're black, they're like completely unapologetic for what they are as structures. And it always makes me think about growing up, buying hi-fi stuff, and if it didn't have a certain level of like menace, then we weren't into it. You know what I mean? Like Bang & Olufsen and all that. I've got like Sonos gave me some speakers that just went in my cupboard because they just weren't hench enough. Plus, they got the spy chip inside, so
just like stay woke.
Yeah, well, I don't know, yeah, something like that. But actually, I don't mind it. But my friends are just like, switch all that off. What are you doing? But my point is, I think that sound systems are kind of an extension of our voice, and when you've got a shout to stay alive, you know, I don't know. That means something to me.
No, I think that idea of the shout, there's like a John Holloway essay where he says like it wasn't the word in the beginning, it was the scream. Like the first act of collective expression for humans is the scream. And I remember my first carnival, I was a kid, my mum took me, she had like a backpack full of samosas because that's what Desi mums do when they go carnival. And I just remember the sound of the speakers, like I thought my ears were going to bleed. I was like fascinated and I wanted to be there, but I was also... It's like a level of terror.
Yeah, I mean, Abashanti, we had this set up in here last week and like masonry was falling off the ceiling and all that. And I just looked around, all the people are like, yeah, this is what we came here to do. You know what I mean? Like, and that's the point though, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Like this holding of space or this statement of like will that comes with building something that just makes so much noise that everyone can hear it.
I mean, because you're not then just holding territory in terms of like, because if you wanted to, you could have done this installation in like Ladbroke Grove, right, and kept it there. But it's here, it's in Somerset House. This whole area has been built from the profits of slavery and colonialism.
Yeah, so it's mine.
Yeah.
That's how I see it. Like, we should do it here. Mm-hmm. Like, if the broken backs of my grandfather like and mother's like paid for it, then I'm going to do it where I damn well please.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I wanted to do it here and continue to do things in spaces like Somerset House, which I love, don't get me wrong. But I don't see the point of sort of being forced into where we're supposed to be. That doesn't make any sense to me. I'm supposed to be everywhere, like, regardless of anything to do with my ancestry. But in light of that, especially, even more so.
I mean, it's a strange form of homecoming, right? Like, where you kind of bring your art to, like, the centre of, like, British cultural production, like, the powerhouse, and you're saying, you can't lock us out of here anymore. And what's more, we're not going to be easily contained here, yeah. Right? We'll bring down the masonry.
100%. Like, 1,000%. You know, look, when I'm here and I see the security men, like, dancing, smiling, happy, because they're seeing black faces on just different faces for the first time, people come up to me quietly and say, thank you for doing this. That's the point.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that, I don't know, I think the main, one of the big problems with this country is the class system. And all of this is just, I guess, connected to that thing. Anything that I can do as an artist that attacks that, I'm going to try and do. Because, like, why not? I actually want the world to be better. So I also like dancehall. Do you know what I mean? So, like, it's not a far leap to join those two things.
I was quite surprised when I saw the installation. Because I went in with some preconceptions, because I guess for me, my relationship with your work starts with security. So I always think of, when I think of your sound, I think of, it's a phrase that Dan Hancock uses in his book, of like a scaffolding pole rolling around like a concrete courtyard, like that sense of like emptiness, hollowness, a city that's like hollowing itself out and that's eating itself. And then there's a tremendous amount of really confrontational, really powerful, quite aggy stuff in this installation, but it's also like a love letter to Carnival, and there's this like shift in the music, there's like dance on one side of the installation, and I think on the other it's just like kind of faces and figures from Carnival, and there's like a real tenderness in it, like almost a vulnerability, right? There's like love in the camera.
Well, I think, one, I love Carnival, and I've been going there since I was a little kid, and for me it was just connected to that memory of being a child, you know, with my late father at Carnival, and I didn't want it to make it about the, you know, terrible things or just totally aggressive, because actually that's not the feeling that Carnival gives me. The feeling that Carnival gives me is of love and of joy and of pride and togetherness and of my father, you know what I mean? So this work in my head is some sort of mausoleum, some sort of ode to him. And that's where I began with composing the music for it. And that poem is essentially really like almost me writing to myself, but so he can hear it in a way. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted it to be true. And I also wanted to put Master Steps Records in the installation. And like when I got the footage and I saw that Wiley thing, I just thought, this is what it's about. It's not about like my gothic dance hall or whatever. It's about, let me make this piece of music front and center to the work.
I mean, that was another like really pleasant surprise, was to see like Wiley like having it large on a sound system, like clearly having the time of his life. Yeah. I guess like when you're thinking about like fathers, until you said mausoleum to me earlier, I didn't see it in the piece until, and then it like clocked. But then there's this other kind of father figure, right? Which is Wiley kind of looking out over not the scene that he built, but the one that built him.
Well, yeah, it's like Simba looking out over his kingdom that he's inherited. Totally. It just, to me, that's the spirit of Carnival. It will never die. You can move it, you can mess around, it will never go, because it's passed through the people, and it's like integral to identity, I think. Like, so it's just like immovable, as much as people want to. And I just feel like Wiley kind of represents that, in so much as like all the things he's done. But
I mean, you've got your own history with him, right?
Yeah, I just knew him from back in the day. But it was, I don't know, it's someone I massively look up to, and I just think actually summed up the spirit of Carnival and many, like all of it, in many ways. And it's like, again, going back to that kid thing, that's when I would encounter those people, because I lived in South London, they lived in East London, so you go to Carnival and that's where you see everyone. And like, you know, my memories of being a teenager, when Nasty Crew had their stand at Carnival and all of that. And it wasn't, you know, it's not just about, for me, it wasn't just about stuff that happened before I was born. It's been present all the way through my teenage and adult life, as well as my childhood, as well as going back to the 70s with my, you know, my family and going there. So I kind of wanted to, I knew that there'd be a lot of archive footage from like way, way back, but I kind of wanted to make sure that it linked to what's happening now.
There's something in Wiley's spirit which speaks to like the chaos and the like spontaneity of Carnival, which you don't get from him when it's like he's been booked for a set 6 months in advance, 10% chance he's going to go. Like,
yeah, but it'll always go Carnival. And there's no Michael Evis to, like, call up and, do you know what I mean, berate.
Like, yeah, I think that there's, you know, it's striking, like, the artists who go and the artists who don't, and the ones that still feel a real connection to it. Because I think, like, thinking about grime, which is a genre that, like, you've been attached to but not contained within in terms of your own work. Mm-hmm. There are the artists who wanted to use it to escape And there are ones who always kept returning. Like, do you see that in terms of relationship with Connor?
Yeah, I mean, my relationship to grime was I used to put on grime nights. I don't really feel like I make grime music. I don't feel I needed to, you know. And I feel like, in a way, it is like carnival. Some people sort of never go because it's just too much drama, or some people go all the time. And I feel that's like to do with confronting some of the harsher realities of like urban London. It is dangerous, you know, or it has been in the past, if you are coming from a dangerous place anyway. Like, it's not dangerous if you like live on the King's Road and you're just like going down the road to carnival, like nothing's going to happen to you. But if you can't, even where you live is dangerous, and all the other people who are in that situation all converge into one place and it's just not policed properly, then things are going to happen. I understand why people don't want to engage with it, but again, for me, it's just like, I'd never want to run from things that are difficult. I'd rather confront them, and that's how they get solved.
I mean, there's a kind of conversation that's happening in the piece between the sound system set of Too Many Men and then you kind of intoning over and over, Black Boy, Don't Die Young. So there's, yeah, I kind of felt this like darkness running through like that party energy, or that those two things affect each other and shape each other.
Well, yeah, I just think it would be disingenuous of me to make a piece that's about carnival and not attempt to tackle the feeling of, oh, something might happen, or what I've witnessed at carnival, you know, many years ago. But then at the same time, you know, for every bad thing that I witnessed a million times more love, people together. And so this kind of like focus that we have on like Black male survival, that we, you know what I mean? We're hit with the statistics, and every time you read a newspaper and it's got someone whose face looks like mine is on the cover, it's because he has been murdered or is a murderer. Like, and so you can internalize that, but like to do that is to kind of forget about everyone else, you know, even within our own community, forget about ourselves. Like, actually, you're more likely to live, love a successful, happy life than you are to be killed in a murder, you know. Why are we so, like, macabre or, like, vain in a way? You can't run from the reality of how big cities like London are. So I guess the work is that I did want to include that tension, I'd say.
I mean, we've had conversations before about London where you've said it is a city that is hard to defend, in that if there was some kind of mass urban uprising, it would be very, very hard to contain it in terms of the police, of the army. Does that have a relationship to your interest in carnival?
Or? Yeah, 100%. I think one of the reasons why the carnival gets such a bad press is simply because there's so many people in a completely ungovernable space. And that happens to be where all the rich people now live. So, no, you know, nothing could happen there and they would report it in this way, because it's like, oh, well, what if all these people decide to actually, like, engage in organised civil disobedience? Like, what then? So we better just make sure everybody feels on edge before they even go, and, you know, there's a lack of support and a lack of funding, a lack of infrastructure and so on. So, yeah, I definitely think they're linked. Look, I live around there, like, there's all these empty houses. You know, there's all this, like, property speculation and stuff like that. And yet, London has housing problems, poverty problems. So any mass congregation of people, of course it's going to be vilified, because that congregation has power. And that's, for me, the power of a sound system is to bring people together in one place, and it's not entirely directly governable. In a traditional sense. So having those things in a space that's also like a maze of tiny streets, I don't know, I guess I like the subversiveness of it.
I mean, so I think it's Mikhail Bakhtin in his work on the Carnivalesque. He says that carnivals are essentially a function of power, because, yes, it's like this pressure valve where all the unruliness comes out and the world's turned upside down, but ultimately that valve is closed again. And so maybe thinking about that in terms of carnival, and that it's like the legitimate space for working class unruliness, but ultimately gets shut off again, is how do you keep that valve open? How do you keep it going?
Well, with respect, he's written that from his position. Like, he's not really shut off again because, like, Wiley exists. Do you know what I mean? Like, all the culture, the music, the thought that comes from that occurrence has changed this country forever. So the tap didn't really get shut off. Just because everyone's like, I actually believe in the agency of the people who decide to go back to work, who decide to behave, not actually the agency of power. That's what they want to believe. And we let them. We're complicit in it as long as they do somewhat of what they say they're going to do. But as soon as that is no longer in balance, that's when we have social disorder. And I think, I don't know, those in power will do well to remember that.
I'm never sure how much I agree with you on this. It just depends on the day. So some days I'm like, yeah, no, obviously, like, you know, the city is like indefensible. But then, like, when I walk around here and I think about how the architecture is like built to inhibit the mass movement of people, I guess maybe your starting point's different. You're like, fuck Central, like, move it to where people have lived and where it's got this complicated relationship to residential buildings. Is that kind of where you're at?
Yeah, well, no, I just think that we're kind of conditioned to sort of agree with somewhat what we're told. And things that are seen as a given never really kind of necessarily made sense to me. So when I walk around here, all I see is like architecture that's just not built for the volume of people. And no amount of like cameras and bollards and all of that is going to change that. It's like just trying to convince people that that ain't the case. But like it's functionally not true. You know, look at how quickly the riots in 2011, like how quickly things spiraled. And then afterwards, everyone was like, oh, you know, everything's on lockdown. And we heard so much about the like police response. In a short amount of time, it felt like the whole city was out of control. I'm a believer in that actually all of us have the ability to change things. I'm not necessarily talking about the force of arms necessarily, but just we all have a certain amount of agency if we actually, one, believe it, and two, communicate with each other, and hence why congregation in some way is important to me.
I was really interested in what you were saying in terms of like, well, it depends where you locate agency. Do you locate it with like, you know, Cresta Dick, Bernard Hogan Howard? Do you locate it with the people who choose to come and go with Carnival? And I thought about that shift of emphasis of storytelling was something that was really interesting in the installation itself. Is that if you wanted to, you could have told like a Claudia Jones story of someone who comes over, someone who like builds a carnival culture and kind of watches it grow. But you start with like immigrant son. So kind of thinking about that like one level of removal being brought up in a diaspora context here, like what perspective does that construct for you? Like what are the hallmarks of it?
It's dislocation. In some ways it's you have a freedom to build your own identity, so you kind of latch on to things that are very current or very close to you. So I felt it would be disingenuous to start or to attempt to tell a story of people like that's someone that's not me. Like I didn't come here on a boat in 1950. I'm born here, I'm a second generation immigrant, I'm an immigrant son. So it starts there because I wanted to tell the truth. And as I see it, looking backwards and forwards, like history, within history there is power. And, you know, the people who tell the story, like, hold the power. So for me it's important to tell a story that I believe is true directly from my perspective.
I mean, there is this kind of, you know, relationship of looking back to the Caribbean. Like, we were talking about this before because I was asking you, like, you know, what's going on with the structure itself in terms of, like, this contrast between organic and inorganic material. So you are kind of casting your gaze back to the Caribbean. Yeah. If you could tell me a bit about it.
So, yeah, like, I didn't really want to leave it as a kind of, like, bare structure. At the beginning, I definitely knew I wanted to use, it's like, scaffolded and it kind of be reminiscent of like housing things. And then as we started thinking about it, I just couldn't shake these images that I have in my head of, if you go back to the Caribbean or any place where it's had a lot of immigration out from it, you have this thing where people have built houses in the countryside with the intention that they're going to save enough money, and they're constantly saving and sending money back to finish these houses. And then sometimes they run out of money, they die, their kids don't want it, and you just have this kind of concrete shell in a bush, basically, and it's just sitting there, and they're everywhere. And it just... I couldn't think of an image more poignant when we're talking about immigration than these ghost houses that are like, look like ruins or relics from lives that never were, lives that are lived here by me and you and us, you understand? Like, but they're there because people didn't come here with the intention of staying. People didn't come with the intention of staying, but like, in order to be safe and in order to make it bearable and in order to thrive, they put culture out, you know, they created stuff, they food, music, art. And we have, you know, this is why we have sound system culture, which, you know, out of this comes rap music, out of this comes rave, you know, drum and bass, dancehall, you know, things back in Jamaica. So it's so culturally important. It kind of spreads from Jamaica with the fact that people just didn't go home.
I mean, there's a Wiley bar about that, right, where it's like, I'm going to go back to my country one day. I only want to get enough dough. I'm not going to get too cozy here in England. I'm going back to Trinidad and Tobago. Like, there was, you know, I think with him as a figure, he was like, I didn't plan on staying here. Like, I've asked him, he's like, Bo's not my home. Like, nowhere's my home. Like, as a black man, I'm not meant to belong anywhere. We're a nowhere people. Is that, I mean, I don't know, to me that seems like a running theme in your work, but you always come back to London, the future of London, the past of London, the ghost in London.
I've learned to like enjoy the dislocation, the feeling of like not really being from anywhere. But I guess I have this thing in my work that I must tell the truth. I must say about my own life and what I see in front of me. And if I'm here a lot, then it will be about here in some regard. But I don't really feel British, because I think the values that we are kind of dealing with in the mainstream at the moment just don't reflect what I believe. So how can I be part of something that just, it's clearly wants to reject me?
You're telling me that you don't stand up with tears in your eyes every time Harry Kane scores a goal or singing God Save the Queen?
I mean, I watched it and I hope that England win at football. You know, like some of my friends hope England lose at football still today. No one wants to say it, but it's the truth. People, I remember my dad was like that. He would support any team other than England. He would have the Scotland shirt on, he would have the whatever. Do you know? And I was like, well, you live here, and like all these, half of these players could be your sons. And he was just like, I wasn't meant to stay here. We weren't meant to stay here. So I don't feel like that. Do I, when I see you arguing with Piers Morgan, do I feel like, yeah, Piers, like, tell her you're right? Do I, and when he says, oh, I'm speaking for all these people in this country, you're not speaking for me. You're never going to be speaking for me. So why are you on TV all the time? And I mean, that kind of alienates me, you know?
I mean, for me, I think, like, we did a panel when we first met, like, ages ago, and we were talking about subcultures, and I was saying that I found it hard to think that subcultures exist, but I think that neighbourhood identity exists in a really strong way. And kind of bring it back to this point of nationalism, I don't feel British at all. I feel, I mean, no offence if anyone's, like, from these places, I feel no personal attachment to Sussex or Skegness or Scotland. What I feel very strongly is that I'm from North London, and like, I know it inside out, and I know where to go, I know where I feel safe, I know where to have fun, and that feels like me. You know, I don't feel English. I also don't feel like an authentic, you know, I'm not one of those, like, you get that with like second generation people of colour, yeah, where they're trying really hard to feel authentic. And you know, they wear saris more often than their cousins do back home. Like, don't feel like that either. I mean, do you feel that there's something in London, there's something particularly about London at carnival time that holds something for you in terms of identity that other things can't?
Yeah, it actually feels, at a time, society feels a bit more cohesive in terms of, you know, what I grew up with and the kind of ideologies that I grew up with. Those people are generally, it feels like, in one place and celebrating that, regardless of race or nationality, you know what I mean? It's like, it's about progression often. So that's what I identify with more than anything. I travel a lot, and I always have. And, you know, I spent my life going back to the Caribbean every year, you know, like a lot. And my dad was living in Africa and stuff like that. So I kind of don't feel any less affinity with any place, really. It's just I can't really talk about things that have happened to me outside of this country when most of, or outside of the city of London, when most of the things that have happened in my life have happened in London. I'm always conflicted about it. I never know whether I'm staying, whether I'm going, if I'm leaving, if I'm going to live here or I'm not going to live here.
Good to keep people on their toes, though. Keep them guessing.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, I think this kind of leads on to where I'm going with this, which is one, the future of Carnival, and two, the future of London and how those two things are connected. Because the existence of Carnival, as we know it, is increasingly precarious, is that they want to make it ticketed. There's been talk about moving it to Hyde Park. There's, you know, every year it's more and more policed, more and more invasively policed. What do you think its future is, and how can we protect it?
Up until pretty recently, I really felt like Carnival in its current state was under threat. That I feel like there is a concerted effort and desire to move it from where it is. And I remember talking about this with my mum, and she said, they'll never move Carnival. And I said, what do you mean? She said, they're not about to let that many black people into Hyde Park at once. And she's right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I actually believe the whole, like, hoo-ha, we're going to move Carnival, we're going to threaten, it's like your grandma holding, like, a stick. I'm going to beat mm-hmm. you. And so you kind of, like, behave.
The difference between my grandma and you was that she would beat me.
Okay. Well, sad for you. Actually, it's like a massive payday for the police. And so, of course, they're going to talk about how dangerous it is. It's like, you know, it's like getting a man to build your house, and he's like, oh, do you know what I mean? We're going to need all these bricks. Oh. Is it like, and that's it, constantly. Because actually moving Carnival, like, think about what would happen if they moved Carnival to Hyde Park and made it a ticket event. Like, think about what would happen in London if they did that. Now, when the police are under-resourced. So they're going to talk about doing it, but they're not going to do it, I don't think. You know, maybe I'm wrong, I hope. You know, as far as I know, in the research I was doing, there has never been, like, a kind of proper, like, flow analysis, like, crowd thing. You know, we live in 2018. If you actually look at the metrics and the politics behind it, it just seems, like, it just seems sus. You know what I mean? So I kind of turn from that, I take everything that I hear about this, like, with a pinch of salt, because the reality is it's become an institution and it has become that pressure valve. And I think that as we head into Brexit time, it's going to become more and more important. Maybe you know, Rees-Mogg will become Prime Minister and he'll try and do that. And then when half the city's on fire, then, you know, it'll be a different story, we'll be talking. But as it happens now, I just don't think it's going to go down that way.
I mean, there's this kind of element where it's also co-opted, right? Where you, but, you know, by the establishment, where they go, oh, look at Carnival, something for Londoners to be proud of. And they're all people who've been born and raised in Hampshire. Yeah. Something for Londoners to be proud of. I was really struck by this when I was looking at the website for Only Connect, yeah. who won, like, one of the big contracts about doing gang exiting stuff. Yeah. And it's... If you looked at it, you'd be like, this has got to be a black-run organisation. It's like pictures of black people everywhere, pictures of black people at Carnival, pictures of black people singing, pictures of black people dancing. Look at the board. Yeah. It's a jar of mayonnaise headed up by none other than Danny Kruger, yeah. who was David Cameron's chief advisor on the Big Society. So enters government, yeah. makes the case to, like, strip the public sector of money, sets up this, you know, thing, Only Connect, which does no meaningful community work whatsoever, plaster it with pictures of black people, and then just sucks up public money to do nothing.
Yeah, of course. It's so he can get more rich. Mm-hmm. That's the reason. I totally see that, and I totally see that mirrored in some of the things that are happening with Carnival. But again, on a basic level, like, it comes down to what I was talking about, agency and power. You can write as many reports as you want, but, like, what will happen? People will just go back out in the street. So what are you going to do? You're going to go and, like, force the sound systems to move. It would take years to do that. And there has to be, like, public will to do that. And aside from a few of the Russians who live by me, who don't care, there is, they don't have any, like, public, there's no will for them to, you know, like, move Carnival. It's such a small sliver of people that want to see that happen. And it, there's so many people that go to it, and it becomes more and more and more important in terms of class in Britain, I feel. No matter how much it gets diluted from what it was and stuff like that, I just don't think it's something that is viable in the short term.
I mean, it's also a case for making sound systems like tanks be like, make them immovable, like these like medieval siege weapons that like you just can't shift. And before we move on to an audience Q&A, because really interested in hearing what you guys all have to say, I guess the future of London, because then if you're hopeful for Carnival, are you hopeful for London in terms of this process of like displacing people from the centre further and further? Sometimes I think of it as like, you know, a donut where that like, you know, inner hollow gets so big that the outside will just sort of have to collapse inwards.
It's up to us though, isn't it?
Do you have a plan?
I've always got a plan. It's up to us, I think. For example, with gentrification and the hollowing of London, like we don't have to be complicit in it. We don't have to sell our houses for massive profits, you know. We don't have to play the game. Like, so it's really up to us. You know, one of the reasons why I did this work and why I continue to do works in places like this is because, like, I'm just not going anywhere. Like, I'm never going anywhere, like, that, unless I want to go there. So I guess I don't know what the future is. It looks uncertain, it looks turbulent, it looks bleak. But then I see so many, like, really young people who are super switched on and super, like, self, super just ready. And I think, actually, this can go one way or the other. It's just down to what we do.
See, I'm so surprised by how hopeful you are. This has been my biggest surprise of the evening. I was just like, is Gaika an optimist? I wasn't prepared for this.
I've always been an optimist. Like, I've always been an optimist. Even in my music, people always tag it as being really dark and so on, but I always try and put hope in it through all the bleakness. There is hope. It's just about, can we see it? Can we engage with it? Can we believe in our own power? And it's, you know, it's confronting the monster underneath the bed and say, like, looking at him dead in the face and being like, I'm not going anywhere. And a lot of my art is about that, just because it's an experience that I had in my life. So yeah, I've always, I wake up hopeful. But I think in order for that to be effective, you've got to tell the truth. So it isn't all kind of rose-tinted goggles and kind of, I don't know, jaunty jazz music. That's not really real to me. But that's not to say I'm a pessimist. I've never been a pessimist.
Quite into closet optimism. I think this is going to be like an idea to like take and like run with. So questions, comments from the audience. Let's start with you.
Good evening, Gaika and Ash. I want to say, Gaika, I commend you for your programme of events here. I don't think I've got to Somerset House in all the years I wanted to, and I came to see the Abashanti Eye event, first time I saw him. And what particularly struck me was the room was full with all races, all colours. And then I was one of the older people in the room. I won't tell you how old I am, but I'm decades old. But what I also liked was it wasn't just about entertainment. Both you and Abashanti Eye spoke, and you put that event into context like you're doing today about Carnival. The other point I want to make was that I've been going to Carnival for close to 30 years. And I used to go by myself and just bump into people there. It was a great atmosphere. And when I went about 20-odd years ago, I'm not a slim person. The way in which the police organised the closure of the roads, making certain roads only passable in one direction or the other, has made it so dangerous. And then they wonder why it kicks off. 100%. That's one point. And the other thing about Carnival is that when you have your big festivals, like, what's the one that happens every couple of years?
Glastonbury.
Yeah, Glastonbury, right? You don't hear the metrics about who got stabbed, who got killed. Occasionally you might hear who nearly died because they took drugs. But all of those big festivals, you don't hear the metrics that come out the very next day about them, but you hear about Carnival. And when it was peaceful, nothing gets mentioned, yeah? But when there's the odd stabbing or whatever, and I'm not condoning that, them bad boys and the occasional bad girls need to keep away, because it's a brilliant event, brilliant event. And it's interesting to hear what you're saying about the ticketing in Hyde Park, because Met Rees-Mogg get in, yeah? And Met can come with that and see what happens.
Exactly.
See what happens.
I totally agree with you, 100%.
So excited about the direction of this Q&A. Like, that's such a great start to it. Do you want to respond, or should we take another?
I just 100% agree. Glastonbury is a smaller event with more crime, but it just doesn't get reported that way. Why? Like, can somebody look me in my eye and tell me why? Because, you know, like, was it last year or 2 years ago, the Met came out and said, oh, we have locked up this many people who are selling heroin.
I was who's taking heroin at Carnival?
This is it. So wait, like, now you can somehow link smack dealers to Carnival. Oh, right. It's just so obvious. But it's just racism, like basic, blatant racism towards black and brown people. And that's the kind of narrative around Carnival. It's just shaped by that all too often. And part of, you know, the poem that I wrote in the piece was living in that, where you're like, you know, it's in the back of your mind when you pick up the metro before and they say, you read the statistic that we've locked away this many people in anticipation of this weekend's festivities, and you're on your way there. So what does that say to young men who are going there? And then they're squashed in. It seems sus to me. Like, it seems designed to elicit a certain behaviour from the people that are there. I just hope that, and it seems as years have gone by, we're just falling for it less.
I mean, when I was at Carnival, this must have been not long ago, either last year or the year before, I saw the same group of young kids get stopped and searched 3 times inside an hour. Like, just, they couldn't get to the end of the street without being pulled over again. I was with some friends and we were talking to the police and we were like, look, they've been stopped, like, not 15 minutes ago. What do you think has happened in that space of time? You know, what do you think's going on? We're like, quite brushed off. And the irony there was, obviously nothing was found on them because they've been stopped 3 times. You're not going to find it on occasion one, you're not going to find it on occasion three. Me and my friends just dropped pills. Like pupils, massive, no risk of being searched. This is like, you know, me and my friend who's, you know, it's like the colour of an oyster, like translucent. No danger of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is what I mean. It's when it's living under this kind of fear of the black body, black people, and, you know, of us as being inherently dangerous, it's going to affect... It's like a basic thing to me. It's like, if society views me as being dangerous, then my voice, amplified by many... you know, hurts and across 2 million people, is always going to be described as being dangerous. But, you know, I actually look at it like this. I'm glad for it because it comes back to class for me. In this country where we kind of still live under the class system, some of them people need to feel a little bit on the edge, you know, like something might happen.
Like there's a guillotine very close behind them.
You know what I mean? So it's like, maybe that's my way of dealing with it and dealing with all of that stuff kind of being thrown at us is kind of the negativity. But, you know, perhaps it's a coping mechanism, but in some regard, I generally look at Carnival in terms of not only love and togetherness, but also defiance.
Also, can I just... point out, in case there's any Daily Mail journalists here, the pills I was talking about was Beecham's cold and flu. Just to establish.
Yeah, I just want to quickly say thank you to the both of you. Like, yeah, I really enjoyed your talk, especially from coming from my perspective, because I do feel like an affinity for a lot of what you're saying. And your last point about like hope and optimism, you being an optimist, I feel like resistance and optimism kind of lie in the same space, and we don't talk about that enough. So, yeah, thank you for that. Basically, my question is, you talked a lot about like placelessness and like a kind of a cultural placelessness, but obviously with your ideas about optimism and system that you've put on here, do you feel like there's like a possibility for like young black British people through like our own DIY spaces and events to actually like kind of create and curate our own like sense of identity? Or do you feel we have to kind of try and like get used to and like find our own identity in that sort of placelessness?
Like I think definitely the former. We can make this for ourselves. You know, one of the reasons why I kind of found myself looking back towards sound system culture, which was something that my dad was into, was because it's like the means of production at the end of the day. If you've got the equipment to make the noise, then you can just go outside your house and do it, and then the authority has to find you. Not you go into the authority and say, please let me in, please rent me your venue, please accept me. You're saying, well, I'm doing it anyway because I've mastered the technology and now you have to catch up. Do you see what I mean? And I feel like just as our parents, grandparents throughout history have done, we can do it. We just need to like tap out of the thinking that says, accept me. Like, if I'm just polite enough, if I pull my pants up, if I'm British enough, if I put on my white voice, then I'm going to be okay, because we're not. Just that's how I see it. So I'm 100% with you, and I say definitely the former. Like, we can build all of this and just do it. You know, and that's not... I don't think it's specific to race. I think it's... You know, I want to say this to young people. Like, you know, there's a massive kind of... space between the ideologies of the people who are like under 30 and those who are over 30. And it's like, it comes back to the same thing for me. What are we going to do? We've got to do something. And we can change the world and make it fairer for ourselves, for our children, you know? But we have to do something. We can't just sit back and like wait for people who are already rich to share wealth. They're not, that's done. Like, it's obviously not going to happen. So, yeah, that's what I think.
More questions, more comments?
I grew up in Dalston, so I'm familiar with gentrification. If Shoreditch is ground zero, we're like right next to it. I'm a youth worker, and I was just thinking about, like, and I'm afraid I haven't seen the... your exhibit, like your stuff in the other room. I'm gonna have to go and see it. But you were talking about like, what are we gonna do? Part of my like, I flip flop between being extremely between grieving for my community and also at the same time like loving it and being optimistic and thinking it can't possibly be stomped out. And I think part of the solution like to gentrification is like. Is more spaces and youth work and community work and stuff, because all of that is being taken away in a very violent way. I was just thinking, like, is there any space in like your work for working with young people and kind of
1,000%?
Yeah,
like hit me up, 100%.
Yeah, seriously.
Thanks. My question is a follow on to the two questions ago, where you said you were positive about people being able to make a space for themselves, and I just wondered, do you think that has been going in that direction over the past few decades, or do you think it's been going in the opposite direction? And if the latter, why do you think that is, and what can be done about it?
I think it's been going in the latter because my generation were bamboozled with the promise of free money and graduate schemes and capitalism being something that works, and also the criminal justice bill, and it's just even existing at any given time kind of made DIY type art spaces somehow like vilified or like not cool, you know? So I think I would love to believe that all the like manor house parties I went to is the trend, but it's definitely not. What do? We resist them. Like, get a sound system and put it in your house. Like, for me, it's like, that's what our parents did. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there was no spaces, there were no clubs or whatever, so they just put parties on in their homes. Why are we not doing that? Because we're afraid of the police. But guess what? There's no police, they've got no cash. So, you know what I mean? Like, if I can, like, in some way, you know, even begin to, like, make that a reality, then if some kid comes in here and thinks, you know what, I'm going to go home, I'm going to do this in the garages that no one's using down the road, because that was dope. And if they can do it there and they can get away with it there and they can do it here, then my job is done.
Yeah, I'm an architect and I study, I research insurgency and like urbanism actually. And like, yeah, I guess it's something to offer that precisely something like carnival and festivals and these kind of things are exactly the practice by which police and governance is it's where they practice kind of precisely the closing down of spaces in order to use exactly the same tactics in kettling during riots, etc. Like they're exactly the same things. And I think what is going to be coming in the next couple of years is it's not even like police or human checks. It's these like, they're like a porta cabin. You have to pass through them. It's a body scanner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I guess I just think it's maybe just something to offer that like, especially from like white person position, that that's technically doing that like, oh, we're not specifying the stop and search, which allows a lot of evasion from like a thing that now definitely people are hot on for sure. But I think it's really important that especially those that are less vulnerable do not comply with that, because it's technically the blanket, right? It's technically fair. I just think it's really important to say that like there are going to be opportunities or confrontations in the next few years where precisely that refusing complicity with that on behalf of those people that, you know, wouldn't get stopped and searched anyway, but now fairly will be, that they also refuse to do so, right? So I just like also want to
100% agree with you.
Also like, yeah, my partner runs a sound system. We're looking to do a squat party after carnival happens every year. We're trying to do a flatbed truck instead of keeping it still or whatever. So it's, I think what's kind of interesting about what you say about this main, like, taking up space and standing still versus that like moving, right? So again, like I literally look at the development of insurgency in urbanism, and it's like that keeping moving is something that's very interesting. And like the riot in and of itself, the Black Bloc, whatever, it actually manages to still function precisely because it keeps moving. You know, the march still works because it keeps moving. It doesn't stand still. And like, I don't necessarily know what's better or worse, because I definitely think on behalf of the most vulnerable that they stand still in defiance, right? Like, I totally am with that. But it's funny that tactics that are developing are precisely to kind of keep moving. And I think that definitely obviously goes with like an ownership of displacement, an ownership of nomadicism, even in the event of the afternoon of a carnival situation, right? But yeah, it's like moving and standing still on our terms, basically, right? I'm sorry I couldn't turn that into a question and it just was like a rant, but yeah.
Would you like to rant back?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. I think that with the latter point, I think that both methods of kind of resistance have validity. You know, I don't think it's a kind of mutually exclusive situation. I think sometimes you got to stand still, sometimes you got to duck and weave, you know? And in terms of the technology, like biometric scanning, you know, all of that stuff, I think it's, for me, it's also important. I mean, it's just because it's what I grew up with. We're aware technically of how these things work, like where the information goes, like how to cheat it if you need to, you know, all of this stuff, because to not is to just assume the kind of like moral fortitude of the people who've created these things, and I just don't trust people who want to scan my eyeballs.
More questions, more comments. We've been fairly carnival tight. You can also ask about star signs.
So like with homelessness, I've been seeing this thing on Twitter where they basically put like a lanyard and they like scan it and you can see their backstories, and this is all to do with like tracking. And this just goes into like housing crisis and how there's so many people around here in areas like this and in other areas as well, all over London, where there's homeless people and in near big buildings. And just as we were walking to like around London Bridge, there was people laying on the floor, and all this extra policing, even though they don't have the funding for it, and all this just adds to disillusionment, and it doesn't change the structures that are put in place in big areas like this. It also contributes to like a lot of just ignorance in terms of ignoring how these structures affect people, because they tend to not affect the people higher up. They affect poor people, working class people, immigrants, and a lot of their stories are muted, and a lot of the times they're just ignored, and it's like something around the community. So I'm Somali, and within this, like, I've known so many people affected by the housing crisis, let alone, and it's never talked about. And there's a lot of ignorance in terms of ignoring the lower people below, because if you know Somali, you know they have large families, they have all these things, and then this just adds to more discrimination that's never talked about. And within my community, there's such a large, like, where a lot of boys, like a lot of these black boys who are unfairly being stopped in search, who are unfairly due to loads of things, loads of factors, loads of things that can't be determined, and it's not all the fault of the government or the education system that isolates them, but it's quite, it's like a weird, like, Black Mirror episode.
I think what you're talking about is the aim that authority has to control people at its margins and just kind of marginalize them, you know, so what their lived experience becomes something that's dislocated from everyone else's, so therefore they don't matter. And I feel like what we've got to do is, like, say it as loud as we can, like, yeah, we matter, you know, like, and really never give up on that.
Yeah, because I think through sharing stories and being able to, even if it's not being seen in the news, even if it's not being shared by mainstream media, if we share it within ourselves, maybe that will make a difference, maybe that will make a change. Because even, like, through WhatsApp groups, even though they do conspiracies and all that, but through that communication within us, and we can open it up. Because I feel like living in London, a lot of the communities are quite connected, but also segregated in their own ways. And that often leads to, like, ignorance, and it leads to, a lot of the times, people just ignoring what is there, ignoring the small things that affect, like, everyday people's lives. It's not talked about, even though we do, like, say it, if it's not loud enough, or if it's not shown in the correct way, what if they're being treated even worse? And then these stories just keep happening and happening and happening, and there's nothing being done about it, because the education system doesn't always help it. And youth unemployment is one of the highest, because not everyone's going to be able to go to university. Not everyone's going to be able to get the job that they want. There's a lot of prejudice on younger people, and there's a lot of lack of acknowledgement on that, especially if they're black or if they're brown or if they're a minority. And it's not just minority communities, because young English white boys are the most likely to not pass schooling.
Not most likely, it's travellers and Roma. So even, yeah, like, within that, there's this, like, invisibilised category. I've been that dork who's, like, gone through the data set. And then what's interesting is how we naturalise alienation and exclusion, yeah, for some groups and not others. So, like, yeah, below that, there's, like, a further... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because I think stereotyping adds to the fact that the reason why all these things are harder for some people, and it adds to why some of these things are more ignored or some of these things are more highlighted. Because if it was a minority, I don't think most people would care about it, and I don't think most people will speak about it. And
Hi there. So a lot of the conversation tonight was around kind of direct action and kind of mass protest and, you know, people assembling in large numbers as a way to kind of, you know, to create change. And it makes you think back to last year when a lot of grime artists were getting behind Corbyn and the election and Labour. And I just wondered whether or not how you felt about the kind of the traditional political process, and whether or not you're hopeful about it or were hopeful about it last summer, and how that ties in with things like Carnival and the sort of protest of people gathering in large numbers.
Can we expect Geica for Corbyn anytime soon?
What do you think? I was hopeful last summer. Now I'm not hopeful about the traditional political process in Britain. I think it's completely broken, and because it's ultimately populated by people who all went to school with each other, all look the same, and just think on, you know, various, like, slight variants of, like, the same thing. I'm frustrated with it, because I just think, like, it seems like we've woken up in a twilight zone and we're just like hurtling towards impending disaster and everyone's sitting there like pointing at each other. You know what I mean? Like not doing anything. Like I picked up the Evening Standard on the way here and everyone's, oh, Corbyn has spent overspent it on a hotel in 2014 and all of this. And it's like, this is the front page of the news. And like Steve Bannon is saying, you will have to fight for your country and stirring up all of this stuff. Like, you know, and people like crashing cars into Westminster and then we're like worried about the minutiae. And it's just like, it's just nonsense. It just seems like utter nonsense. And I don't know, it's like nonsense on the internet. And I'm just done with it. I'd rather concentrate on like things that are happening in real life.
I mean, like to push on this point a bit, because I oscillate wildly between feeling really hopeful that there's a chance at, you know, kind of fuzzy social democracy, which is better than what we've got now, and then also thinking that doesn't address the, like, structural issues with the state, with capitalism and all the rest of it. So I kind of, you know, it depends what day you get me on. But that, to me, seems like a damning indictment of our media. But inherent to the Corbyn project, like, doesn't that not bolster lots of the stuff that he says, which is that you don't reflect the experience or the concerns of millions of people in this country, and at some point at the ballot box, there will be a reckoning? He says that with his eyes.
Like, I don't know. Is there going to be this reckoning at the ballot box?
Inshallah.
I don't know if there is. Like, I think my issue, 100%, with basically the Labour Party is during the Brexit debate, instead of saying, hey everyone, your country's not been overrun by like dark people from the East, and if it was, so what? They said, oh, maybe you've got a point, and pandered to it. And now we're here. And like, I just can't take any of it seriously after that. You know what I mean? Because it's like, you know, you had like a few idiots, you know, Farage and that, they rolled out their bus with all the Turkish people, and you had these people in the north saying, oh, there's all these people, I want my country back. And instead of actually saying, this is not right for these reasons, and like, come on, the British Empire is over. Let's face it. Those people at the top of the Labour Party went, okay, kind of get it.
Legitimate concerns.
Yeah, and like, I can't be optimistic after that, because at the time I was like, this is just playing into like global nationalism, like white supremacy, white supremacist politics. This is a thing. And then I said, nah, you're crazy, man. And now what? Like, Boris is out here calling Muslim women postboxes and robbers, and saying, yeah, I'm not sorry. And it's fine. What?
And being advised directly on Bannon to do that. They have some meetings. Boris comes up with some culture war stuff, doesn't back down on it. And yeah, I agree, there's no strategy on that.
And yet the Labour Party, instead of like doing what it's supposed to do, is spending its time skewering itself. So how can I say to anyone, go vote Labour? Like, as much as I'm a Labour voter, I grew up deep in that. I'm just confused by it, and I just think, okay, look, the only thing that I feel that I can do is make a difference to culture that will help create an environment where a like more viable alternative will emerge from or force what's happening now. So I am hopeful for the action of people, you know, but am I hopeful in the short term Grind for Corbyn is going to deliver us real change? I don't know.
What about Drill for John McDonnell?
A drill for John McDonnell, that would be amazing. That would be amazing. At least they mean it. Like, do you know what I mean?
We've got one more question. Any other hands as well? So let's go, yeah, across, and then we'll take you on.
So I just want to say something positive to end the night, that Carnival is totally related to London and community, because it exists because of the mass camps that are communities that come together to create the art that goes on the road. And that's what I love about it. And that's how we can be optimistic, that it brings everyone together for those 2 days of the year, it's the most important thing. It's cross-generational, it's cross-everything, and that's why we all love it, isn't it? So I just wanted to ask, what's your favourite carnival memory, or what's the best thing you found in the archive footage?
The best thing I found in the archive was probably the stuff I put in the installation, as much as Wiley. That was the thing that struck me that moment, because it just kind of resonate. It's like old school but new school. So like, if you're 18, that's old school, but to me, that's new, right? So I kind of like that about it. My best carnival memory has to be in the 90s, when there was Jay-Z and like Tim Westwood had like Jay-Z and Foxy Brown and all the like big stars and like Glamour Kid there, and I just thought. And it was free, and everybody I ever knew ever in the whole of London was just there in that moment watching Glamour Kid awkwardly perform. So,
thank you. 3 quick points. I liked what you said about carnival, but I think we should also remember where it came from. It came from the murder of 1 or 2 black men. That's what led to carnival. So your point is a really important one, but we must remember that it came out of a political imperative. The thing about Labour, I totally agree with you, Guyka, lifelong Labour Party voter, struggling right now, really struggling right now. And this is even before the Corbyn project, all that kind of nonsense. Had to vote last time nationally. Locally, did a different thing, because my local Labour councillors are rubbish. The third point...
What's your council? Just out of curiosity.
Lewisham.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, you understand me? You know, so we've got Gotham City going on, because they're all taking backhanders to build these... And, you know, don't get me wrong, we need housing. But the people them that are buying up those housings and are occupying them are not the local people who are homeless. It's the people them who are investing in those penthouse flats. Third point, we all need to be geeks. You know why? When they're telling us this rubbish about giving us, taking back our country and all that nonsense, we need to come back with them with hard facts. And if more of us became geeks, we could challenge and do what you did, which is to speak to one another, what you said rather, to speak to one another and teach each other about the hard facts, about what Brexit actually means, you know, and challenge the racism. And challenge all the Tories. They're busy taking their companies out of Europe and doing all, you know, other parts of Europe and doing all that nonsense. Rees-Mogg.
I 100% agree with those points, and they were excellently made. And I thank you all for coming and sharing with us. I don't know, I'm kind of blown away. I never expected, you know, like, you never expect to make things that resonate in any way with people, especially when it's kind of not cool to care. It's not cool to have an opinion, you know. The last thing I want to say is that I just feel like, you know what, you can have a brain in your head and like be lit, you know. And I feel like nights like tonight just, I don't know, just make me feel like I'm doing the right thing. So thank you.